This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a world of males and females, Kate Bornstein thinks of herself as neither. Bornstein was born male and did his best to become a convincing man, although he never felt convinced. In the mid-1980s, when he was 38 years old, he had surgery to physically alter his gender to female. But he soon realized that the surgery didn't completely transform him into a woman. So now Kate Bornstein thinks of herself as transgendered. Her memoir, Gender Outlaw, is about the nature of gender, sex, and identity. Her new novel, co-authored with Caitlin Sullivan, is about gender-bending erotic adventures in cyberspace, where you don't need a surgeon to change your gender. I asked Kate Bornstein what it was like, after surgery, to wake up thinking she was now a woman.
Oh, the waking up was fabulous. No, don't get me wrong. I woke up in the hospital room, and I went, oh, my gosh. Because I had, like, when I was a little kid, I had prayed every night, please, God, let me wake up and be a girl, I mean, at that age. And then I woke up out of the anesthesia, and, wow, for all intents and purposes, I had done it. Of course, living the next year or so proved me that I hadn't, but for that moment, it was wonderful.
So what was the turning point for you when instead of starting to think about yourself as a man or as a woman, you started to think of yourself as transgendered?
Well, I was hanging out with a bunch of lesbian feminists for the most part. That's where I was back in Philadelphia. And they were asking me some pretty intelligent questions, like, how can you be a woman if you don't have the history that many women in this culture have? How can you be a woman if you can't give birth? Although we know some women who can't. We want to know how. And they weren't being antagonistic. They were genuinely curious. And I love that when someone's genuinely curious, and it made me think. And I thought, well, if you take those factors into account, then I guess I'm not. And that just pulled the rug right from underneath me. Because I knew I wasn't a guy. I still don't feel like a guy. And I know I'm not a woman.
So before you arrived at this new identity of yourself as like none of the above,
yeah.
Well, did you go into this like incredible depression thinking, well, then what am I?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, I mean, what are we allowed to be? We're allowed to be boys or girls. We're allowed to be men or women. I grew up thinking, wow, this is it. You know, I'm a man for all intents and purposes. And when I heard about this possibility of what was being called a sex change, I thought, oh my gosh, that's it. I am really a woman. That must be it. And to be faced with the prospect of being neither in a culture that says you've got to be one or the other. Yeah, I was depressed. I was horribly depressed. Now it's a hoot.
You've come to think of gender as a social construct. In other words, that gender is really a combination of learned behaviors and attitudes and beliefs. So if you had thought that before your surgery, do you think you still would have had surgery?
That's like such a great question. I have no idea. I think I would have waited longer before actually deciding, because I went into it, Terry, believing that gender was biology and that biology was destiny, this whole thing. I believed it was all genitalia, and that once my genitalia were modified to look sort of like a woman's genitalia, then everything would be fine. But it's not even genitalia is what I found out, and that's what the hoot is. I mean, there's so many different kinds of genitals. There's so many different kinds of hormones or chromosome combinations. It's impossible to bottom line what's a man and what's a woman.
What have you come to think of as the differences between men and women besides their anatomical construction?
I could get smart and sassy, but I think what it really boils down to is a power differential within any given culture. And I think that's what it boils down to. I could be cute and I could say, oh, well, you know, No, I can't be cute about it. There's nothing cute about gender at this point in our culture. I think it's a game that's being played out to keep half of the world's population oppressed.
So you don't think there are any real differences between men and women except for what we kind of socialize them into being?
Well, I think there are biological differences of people born with penises and people born with vaginas and vulvas and that equipment. I think, sure, there's sometimes height differential, sometimes there's weight differential, sometimes there's muscular differential. But what other kind of differences are we looking for? Are we saying that the difference is temperament? And that can be controlled hormonally? I don't think so. I don't think there's that much of a difference. I think we'd probably find that we're a lot more similar if we were given the opportunity to explore what's called masculine or feminine behavior.
How much was your desire to change gender a function of sexuality, of wanting to sexually function as a woman?
Actually, very little, because I went into this whole gender change, Terry, with the whole idea that I wasn't going to be sexually active at all. I figured, who would want me? I was interested mostly in women. I had always been interested in women in my all my life, romantically. I'd had a few sexual encounters with men, which I enjoyed, but my romantic interest was always women. So I didn't do this so that I could be sexually active with a man. In fact, my surgeon told me that, well, golly, there's a lot of tissue deterioration here, because what they do is they invert your penis to form the vaginal cavity. And they said there was a lot of deterioration from the hormones I'd been taking, and that it wasn't going to be very deep. And I said, well, you know, I'm a lesbian, so I don't need that kind of depth. And he looked at me and goes, oh, right, okay. He was a very cool doctor.
It certainly makes all categories very confusing when someone is in your shoes.
And it's also hard to buy shoes my size.
I'm sure that's true. What are some of the things you learned to do differently when you started living as a woman?
Wow. Well, the working thing, I think, was probably the biggest thing I had to learn. I was working at an IBM subsidiary at the time, and I was doing sales. And selling as a guy, first you had to get past the secretary or the receptionist and get yourself into the decision maker. And that meant either flirting or somehow doing the guy-girl thing. And then once you got to the decision maker, then it was, okay, let's talk here. The decision maker usually being a guy, and in the time when I was doing it, you talk to this decision maker and you say, okay, let's talk some turkey here. Let's see what you need. And I tried that as a woman, Terry, and it didn't fly at all. People were like, they were calling me a castrating bitch, and I wasn't doing anything different at all until I changed the style of my selling. And instead of saying, well, let's talk turkey here, I'd say, well, gosh, what do you think? I mean, we've laid out your needs, and you probably know better than I do, and it looks like this would be right for you. What do you think? And I went, oh, I get it. I get it. They have to be powerful. They have to be right. And that kind of dynamic is what I found plays itself out on pretty much every level of my daily life these days. I found out a whole lot about that stuff.
Do you think you walk differently or talk differently as a woman than you did as a man?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I was, you know, I did phone sex for a couple of years to pay the bills. And
To pay your surgery bills?
No.
Or just to pay bills in general?
Just to pay bills in general, the rent. And, you know, I was doing theater at the time, and that didn't pay anything. Still doesn't. But I did phone sex, and I was doing pretty well at it. And guys would get on the line and they'd say, you know, hey, Stormy, you've got a voice like an angel. You were born to do phone sex. And I'd think to myself, you know, not really. You know? I mean, but, you know, because I wasn't born with this voice, Terry. You know, I was
born with this voice. You know, I had this kind of a deep voice of a guy, right?
Well, no, but you're faking that voice. Give me your real guy voice.
My real guy voice was probably down around here, I would think, and I'm trying to like unlearn all this stuff. I went to a voice teacher, and she went through this whole thing of raising my pitch. They wanted me to talk way up here, Terry, and then add breathiness and modulation and tag questions. You know what I mean? And I thought, I don't want to talk like that. So I taught myself how to talk by listening to Laurie Anderson records.
So you have what would be considered a high voice for a man and a deep voice for a woman.
Bingo.
No, in that little demonstration of what the speech teacher was telling you, there was also a put a smile in your voice. I'm wondering if people expect you to smile more as a woman than they did as a man. I've noticed like with photographers are more likely to ask a woman to smile than a man.
People stop me on the street and say, honey, smile. I'm going, excuse me? please. You know? No, I don't smile as much as a woman who was born a woman and is my age, was socialized to smile. I don't do that. No, unfortunately, yeah. I hang out mostly in the lesbian community. And within the lesbian community, that kind of woman socialization is not exactly encouraged.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kate Bornstein. She's the author of the memoir Gender Outlaw and co-author of the new novel Nearly Roadkill, which is about gender and transgendered identities on the internet. And Kate has had a sex change operation, male to female, but now considers herself to be transgendered, neither exactly male nor female. And she's kind of challenging the whole idea of gender-specific traits. Let's take a short break. And then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Kate Bornstein, her memoir, Gender Outlaw, is her account of growing up male, getting surgically transformed to female, and ending up feeling transgendered. I know when I'm walking down a street, especially a dark street at night, I wish that I could look really imposing, which is kind of hard for me to do at my height. But you're what?
How tall are you?
I'm a little over 5 feet, whereas you are over 6 feet.
Just under 6 feet, yeah.
Just under 6 feet, yeah. So, I mean, you could do the imposing thing probably a lot more easily. Do you try to use kind of guy approaches to walking down the street on dark, lonely streets?
Yeah, and I was actually mugged about 4 years ago. It was in Philadelphia, right outside the train station. I was going down one of those stairs that are on the street down into the subway system.
Mm-hmm.
And I came around the corner, and this guy was all of a sudden holding a knife in my belly. And I went, oh, my gosh. And I was having a bad day anyway. And so my height, my appearance, nothing was stopping this guy. And I figured, I've got a meeting I've got to get to. I just bellowed at him in my guy voice. I said, you know, get the F out of my face. And he jumped. He jumped like 14 steps up the stairs. And he started looking at me and went, faggot, faggot, faggot. And I went, God blessed right, you get out of here. And I didn't care what he thought I was. I just wanted him gone. So I've got that advantage, yeah.
Not the time to stop the mugger and say, no, really, I'm transgendered.
Yes.
Let me explain the concept.
Can't you hear? No, I really am a woman. And you're right. Here, take all my money. And, oh, dear. What is this? Oh, man.
Well, I think one of the things you really have going for you in this situation is that you come from theater. You've always been in theater. I mean, since I think high school.
Yeah.
So this sense of display and that an aspect of life always is theater, is just a kind of part of your, that's in your blood. So it's probably easier for you and even pleasing for you to use that kind of public display and confusion in a way that connects with your sense of identity.
I like it, and that's a good point. And it's like what you were saying just a few minutes ago about how you walk down the street and try to, like, give this impression that you're untouchable, people shouldn't come near you. You probably walk faster and you look ahead. But doing that kind of display, theater as display, does not work on a day-to-day level. It doesn't work in relationships. I had to get rid of, I had to name for myself what I didn't like about myself that I considered male or man, and literally get rid of it. One I'd already mentioned was this whole idea of assuming I belong. This whole idea, this attitude of I deserve all of this, which is what many, many, many males are raised with, especially in this culture, is I deserve, you deserve. I was raised believing I could be president of the United States, Terry. How many girls are raised with that? I don't think so. So that does color things.
Kate, what kind of man were you before you had your sex change operation?
It depends on what time of my life you are asking. I think in grade school and high school, I was just a scared kid. In college, I started to get the idea that people would really believe whatever I put out there. And I remember I had this part in a show where I had to play this macho guy, and it was maybe in my sophomore year of college. And I learned how to do this macho walk, this kind of, hey, I'm bad kind of thing. And people believed that's who I was. For a long time, people believed I was very, very macho, and I kept that up. I think, though, I was basically your nice Jewish boy.
you know, you're kind of a little bit nebbishy, a little bit geeky, a little bit nerdy kind of guy.
Now, you reprint in your memoir a yearbook photo of you in which you're sporting quite a big mustache. And I'm wondering what the mustache phase of your life was like. Why you, of all people, had a mustache?
Oh, God, that was to keep me from dressing. I was dressing compulsively. I mean, that's part of it. You know, like when you really don't take a look at gender, you think it's all in clothing. And, or at least I did. And I would dress at every opportunity, dress as a woman. And once I had the mustache, couldn't really do that very well. And pass anyway. So I kept the mustache, sometimes a beard. I also kept on a lot of weight. I was up to 240 pounds at one point. Just so that I didn't have to deal with this stuff. So I could say, okay, I look in the mirror, I see a guy, that's all I want to see. I don't want to pay attention. Put my whole life on hold.
And when did you shave it?
Actually, after I the most embarrassing thing in my life is that I used to be a member of a group called Scientology, and it was after I got out of Scientology that I actually shaved the mustache and started exploring this gender stuff for real.
How do you explain the Scientology part of your life? I ask you that because you're obviously embarrassed about it.
I think, you know, I was at a vulnerable point coming out of college. The next step, I was an actor, and the next step was for me to go to New York and seek my fortune in New York as an actor, and that scared me so much that I decided to take a trip across country, and I ran into Scientology, and they were promising the sun, moon, and stars, and they also had like sections of their work where they came down real hard on gays, lesbians, and perversions, as they called it, and I figured, well, geez, you know, these people have got me pegged. That must be the group to belong to. So I did. And I considered my time in Scientology as amends for being such a twisted, evil, disgusting person.
Did it help you at all?
Oh, sure, I guess. I mean, I think I spent a little too much time there, Terry. It was about 11 years. So I don't think I got 11 years worth of goodie out of it. But there weren't all evil people in that group.
Kate, maybe you can help me with this. I'm always curious about this. It often seems that transsexuals and transvestites are more into being a female, you know, like, quote, feminine kind of woman than most women I know are. You know what I mean? Like, most women I know, they wear, you know, jeans and slacks, and to get dressed up, wear really nice slacks and, you know, flat shoes. I mean, I've never worn high heels outside of like junior high when I get dressed up or something.
Yeah.
And I mean, yet like men who consider themselves to be feminine just put on, you know, real heavy drag. You know, I don't know if you wear heels or stuff like that, but you know, heels and dresses and fashion, and it's like they're trying to be a woman that most of the women I know don't or have never even tried to be.
I agree. And I went through that phase myself. I think if you're forbidden from dressing some way, and you see these television shows and these ads that show if you dress this way with high heels and a flowing skirt and you flip to your hair like Marsha Brady, then you're adored, you get taken to the prom, you get bought flowers. This is the myth that goes on. And if you're a man going toward being a woman, then you were responsible for helping to generate that myth. So you've got, you know, a stake in it. And it takes you a while to learn that, oh, wait a minute, these heels are killing me. I hate them. I don't want to spend, you know, 20 minutes to a half hour putting makeup on every morning. I don't care. I'm going to cut my hair short so I don't have to fuss with it. You learn that stuff as you go on. But I think at first, no, you go overboard. And the same way going the other way, female to male, transsexuals and transvestites and transgendered people, by and large, go a little bit too far. They get really macho at first. And then you kind of settle down into a good expression of yourself.
So do you consider clothing now to be an important statement about identity? And how do you dress?
I dress fabulously, Terry. I am having such a good time. I have been like politically active for 10 years, and I've been kind of politically correct about all this stuff and kind of going, all right, well, I will be very conservative here. But nah, you know who my role model is now?
Not me.
No, well, it's like Gina Davis in The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's great. Oh, it's great. She does this whole thing where she plays her own kind of evil twin, only it's not an evil twin. And I like that evil side of her. And so I'm kind of doing that kind of thing. Emma Peel-ish kind of a thing.
So what clothes does that require?
Oh, lots of black, very gothic. Sometimes heels, but mostly boots. I like fingerless gloves. I like fishnet tops. And sometimes I just wear, you know, like a t-shirt and jeans, but mostly black.
A Marquis de Sade look.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I played the Marquis de Sade in college.
Did you really?
Yes, I did. I also played Mack the Knife. I had a lot of fun acting.
Kate Bornstein is the author of the memoir Gender Outlaw and co-author of the new novel Nearly Roadkill. She'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kate Bornstein. Her memoir, Gender Outlaw, is her account of growing up male, surgically transforming herself to female, only to figure out she wasn't exactly that either. Transgendered is the word she now prefers. Bornstein also co-authored the new novel, Nearly Roadkill, about gender-bending and erotic adventures on the internet. Kate, when you told your mother, which I assume that you did, that you were getting a male-to-female sex change operation, what did she tell you? What did she say?
Her first response is, she said, "Why are you telling me this? Why don't you let me go to my grave, believing I have a son?" And I explained to her, I said, "Well, if I didn't tell you now, then I'd never be able to see or speak with you again." And her first response was, "If you go through with this, if you really go through with this, then don't bother coming back here because you're not welcome in this house." And I guess it was for about maybe 5 or 6 months we were on really tense terms with each other. And it wasn't until I called her and told her what a rough time people were giving me at work that she got it and she started calling me Kate. I guess this whole mother-child thing is just a lot more important than something as silly as gender.
Did she ever tell her friends about you?
She told some of her friends, but she lived in a very small town down the Jersey Shore, and some people would have been unkind to her and cruel to her, and she had no way of judging who would be what. So she'd only told a very tight group of her friends. Which meant that every time I went back to visit her, some people would wonder, who is this tall woman coming to visit you from time to time?
So some people thought that she had a son and some people thought she had a daughter?
Most everybody on the shore, because again, it was a small town, knew that she had me as a son and my brother. They knew she had two sons. So there would be times when I would be out to dinner and we'd meet a friend of hers, and they'd say, "Oh, Mildred," they'd say to her, "look, you know, this is so nice to see you. Where's your son, Albert? I haven't seen him." And they would be asking this right in front of me. And she would say, "Oh, Albert's on the West Coast." And I'd be sitting right there.
And were you understanding or angry?
Oh, you know how kids get. At first, I was angry. At first, no, I was insistent that she use the quote-unquote right pronoun because, you know, I was being a woman, and I wanted her to say she and her and Kate and all that. And after a while, we both kind of would laugh about it. She would call me Albert or he, and it really didn't matter. It really didn't matter.
You had a nice piece in the New York Times Magazine in the hers column about what it was like at your mother's funeral when you ran into some of her friends who couldn't figure out who you were. Had you planned on how to handle it before you went?
Oh, goodness, no. The only thing I planned, I knew my mom. My mom had breast cancer, and we knew she was dying. And I was living on the West Coast at the time. She was still in New Jersey. So every time I would come to visit her, I would pack this black dress just in case. And sure enough, this one time I was there, she passed. It was pretty bad. I was really, really upset. We'd gotten to be such good friends. At the funeral service, I was standing there by the coffin crying and crying, and these women would come up to me, and there were little old ladies with blue hair and kind of rhinestone cat glasses, and they'd look up and go, "Who are you?" I go, I'm Kate Bornstein. I'm Mildred's daughter." I'd have to think what to say. You know, I have to think, you know, what can I tell these people? And they'd look at me and they go, "Daughter? Daughter? Mildred never mentioned she had a daughter before. Who's your father? It's not Paul, am I right?" And, you know, and then I could just hear the gossip going on. You know, "Mildred has a daughter, did you see? And Albert, Albert never even came to the funeral." Oh, God.
Oh, that's strange.
Yeah. And then people would, like, call me by the wrong name at the funeral, and I couldn't get upset by that. I was so upset by my mom. And they would get upset. They would get doubly upset. And I go, don't worry. It's okay.
What kind of woman was your mother? I mean, gender-wise, was she what you'd call, you know, feminine or what?
Barbara Stanwyck. Uh-huh. You know, she was strong. She was, like, really, really strong woman. She was definitely feminine, if you want to call it that. She considered herself a lady, and most people who knew her considered her a lady.
Did she give you any advice on how to be a woman?
Oh, yeah. Don't come downstairs without your makeup. Don't come downstairs in a bathrobe. And never trust another woman.
That's very retro advice, don't you think?
My mom was very retro. She was born at a time and in a culture where all of her value as a woman was based on the men in her life. Uh-huh. Her father was a successful merchant. Her husband was a successful doctor. She gave birth to two sons. Within a Jewish setting and in the time, you know, like the early 1900s and the mid-1900s, when she was living, this was very important. And so when her father died, her husband died, and one of her sons became a lesbian, this kind of shook her world, you know. This kind of shook her world up a bit. And God bless her. She, you know, took her about a year, and then she finally said, "Well, there's nothing I can do about it. I might as well find out who you are." And we started talking. We started from square zero.
Well, I'm glad that you ended up having such a good relationship.
Yeah, it was important.
Well, I want to ask you about your new novel that you've co-authored. It's called Nearly Roadkill, and the novel takes place on the internet. And the point of the novel is that the internet is a place where you could be any gender you want to. No one will be the wiser. What's the difference between how men and women relate on the internet?
I don't know, because I don't know whether I've met the women I've met or the men I've met were really men or women. So I don't pay attention to that anymore. I don't know. And I think what's fun is when you can find someone to play with, if you can agree to say, okay, let's be a pair of gay guys today. Let's go on the net and be a pair of gay men and see what trouble we can get into. Or the next day, let's go online and be let's be left-handed Lithuanians, or let's be circus performers. Let's tell everybody we're in the circus.
Do you suspect that there's a lot of very macho men or, you know, confident feminine females who, once they get online, like, change gender and have a good time and don't tell anybody?
Absolutely. I've talked with quite a few of them. And it's fun. It's fun because you can encourage that. I've talked with macho guys, and I've said, because, look, when I did Phone Sex, the biggest fantasy, Terry, was, well, what's it like to be a lesbian? You know, and what do lesbians do? And can I be a lesbian with you? That most of the guys that would call wanted to have lesbian sex with a lesbian, and so that's what they do online. I mean, trying to find a lesbian online is difficult. You usually find a guy.
Let's talk about phone sex a little bit. What were the common fantasies that you found?
Guys wanted to be dominated, and guys wanted to be turned into women, and guys wanted to have sex as a woman with a woman. Those were the common ones.
Have you thought about why?
I think it gets back to, again, the pressure that's on guys to be stuck in this one rigid identity, this masculine, macho kind of identity. Even where macho isn't part of it, there's still a rigidity that goes with the concept of man that women don't have. And I think guys need a break. And why not? Go ahead, be, you know, like, they think the only break is being a woman, and they think they have to pretend and hide, and then they feel guilty. But why not just go on and say, I'm not going to tell you what my gender is, but I am being a woman right now. If you can deal with that, then let's talk.
Do you think that some of the people who had these fantasies when having phone sex would leave the phone and then like rigidly uphold gender stereotypes of what men and women are supposed to be?
Absolutely. I had this one regular client who was, if you believed him, he was a high-powered executive, and he would tell me about all of his marketing deals, and we would talk about marketing for the most part, and then he had this like one fantasy where he would always want to have sex with me on top of laundry equipment. He thought that was really sexy. But for the most part, we would talk about, you know, marketing ideas. And then he would go back to his work. He would always call from his office.
Did you find that laundry equipment thing kind of mysterious?
There's stuff I can't say on the air, but yeah, I got to a point doing the phone sex and listening to people's fantasies. I was able to be a lot more compassionate, not only with them, but with myself. And I thought, well, golly, you know, I don't have this laundry equipment thing going with my sex thing, so I can be a little understanding about that.
I wonder if you ever envy people who don't really give much of a thought to their gender. They just are what they are. It's not an issue one way or another.
It's a double-edged sword. I deeply envy people who don't think about it. I personally have never gone to bed a night in my life knowing what gender I am. Not one night, Terry. And I wonder, am I that screwed up? I guess. And then part of me thinks, well, I'm intelligent. Maybe I'm onto something here. Maybe people should be thinking about gender. Is gender something that's, especially the bipolar gender system where there's two and two only, is that something that's so insidious that it's got a lot of people fooled? I don't know. I feel like the kid who pointed at the emperor and said, hey, he's not wearing any clothes.
Is there anything that you would really like someday to experience that's associated with manhood or womanhood that you feel you haven't experienced yet?
You know what, Terry? I don't think so. I really don't think so. And I think I've done it. Here we go. I want to continue my acting. I would like to one day just play a normal old role on stage that didn't have anything to do with gender, or oh, look at the freak, or that would be nice. That would be really nice. Just to play a 50-year-old woman on stage, that would be great.
Well, Kate Bornstein, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Wow, thank you.
Kate Bornstein is the author of the memoir Gender Outlaw and co-author of the new novel Nearly Roadkill.